I'm trying to advance a slide and get in that little circle, so I'm glad you guys aren't seeing here, but if I seem like I'm pausing, I'm waiting for the computer to catch up to me. It should at least play the Jeopardy theme or something while it's doing this. I have some video clips in here as well, so it's a fairly large file. Here we go. Okay, sorry about that. All right, and the interesting thing is, while we were primarily developed to deal with all the propeller engines, while this was all going on, the fledgling development of jet engines was developing, and by the time we brought the altitude wind tunnel on time, it turned out that online, the first project we did was actually the Bell 59 with its twin turbojet engines. Makes for an impressive sight inside this wind tunnel. And it's so it's kind of interesting from that way, even where as we're developing these technologies, and we still kept working on piston engines, but and looking at the cooling and such, but right alongside was coming up with the jet engine technology. Now, take you inside some of the other things, not all just about engines and running the engines themselves. Some of the images you hear is fuels and lubricants, key parts of engines, as you all know real well. Looking at those things, how do we develop the right combinations of fuels, lubricants? Looking at internal combustion engine research. Of course, the controls, the engine controls, be able to check in them, monitor them, work that we still continue today. Propeller vibration lab, obviously that's a key factor. And then heat treat shop, looking at new materials. As we want to get engine temperatures up, we need new materials that can endure and handle those as well. Here's a B-29. It was used for in-flight research and some activities that we did. The Super Fortress was a great platform there. And here's testing the power plant for that, the Wright R-3350. The B-29 had four of those, and here it is being tested in the altitude wind tunnel. I mentioned a really large refrigeration plant, and so one of the other aspects of in terms of, we're talking about towards practical solutions, during World War II, our forces were flying supply routes over the Himalayan mountains, and we weren't losing aircraft to enemy fire, we were losing them to icing conditions. So to come up with practical solutions, what we did is we took that refrigeration unit and developed the icing research tunnel, which is a premier facility of its kind in the world. It's gone through a few refurbishments over the year, but still one of our most active wind tunnels. Industry comes to us and runs to get certifications for the FAA in terms of icing conditions. In that, over the years, we developed anti-icing techniques. Everything from heating elements to boots that expand and get rid of the ice. Various things. And here it takes you kind of a little bit inside. The first image, you can see it when it neared completion in 1944. And General Henry Hap Arnold was there to visit that. Here you can see the first test that was run. And you can see, you got to go in there right afterwards wearing the parkas, doing your measurements, and that's still the way we do it today. And then you see the fuselage of a P-39. After one through some icing. So it's icing not only on the wings, but on the engines as well. We've had rotorcraft in there and various things over the years, very important. Here now shows you what the ARRL looked like after the major facilities were constructed in 1945. Pretty much most of those facilities are all still standing. Most of the altitude wind tunnel did come down a few years ago. Excuse me, it was just starting to deteriorate, but we still have some of the sections of that preserved. Of course, Bill mentioned George Lewis, and he was the director of aeronautical research from 1924 to 1947, and after he passed away in 1948, we, in his honor, were renamed the Lewis, still NACA, Lewis Flight Propulsion Research Laboratory. I just want to give you a little bit of a soundbite from our current namesake, John Glenn, and just talk a little bit about, from his perspective, how he as a pilot benefited, even though it wasn't part of NACA, how he benefited from some of our research. So enjoy this.
Well, of course, I was a fighter pilot in the Marine Corps in World War II, and we were flying the old Corsair at that time, the F4U it was called at that time, really the inverted gull wing. And of course, there were a lot of the airfoil considerations for that airplane. that were developed by NACA. And it was a, so I benefited from that, and in later years, I became after the Korean War, then I became a test pilot, went through test pilot training, and we had the, at that time, we had the whole new stable of aircraft that were beginning to get into supersonic flight, and were faster and could carry more load, and all the developments that came with those airplanes that became the new breed of jet aircraft right after World War II. And that's when we were doing a lot of our test work. And so we were actually doing test work on a lot of the things that NACA had developed through the years and became the basis for all this new, group of airplanes that had new characteristics and new capabilities in speed and load carrying capabilities and range and engines and power, and it was a whole new time of advancement. So I was very much involved with the user end of this.
That was recorded just a couple of months ago. I had a privilege of visiting him in his office and doing some interviews. These are available on YouTube as well. But thought it would be good to hear from his perspective. As Bill mentioned as well, we did a lot of research in various areas. Let me jump ahead to some of the slides. And actually preparing for space before the head of time. And here it goes, as we just saw from John Glenn, a little piece of interesting too. If you recognize that gentleman, that's Neil Armstrong. He actually began his career with the NACA as a research pilot at the Lewis Research Center, as it was known then, and became a pilot, worked with us for about a year, a little less, then transferred out to what is now known as the Armstrong Flight Research Center. And so very appropriately, so I thought I'd mention that as well as a little bit of background. But we actually started working on various rocket technology, actually going back into the 40s, looking at rocket fuels, those types of things, the development of liquid hydrogen in particular as a propulsion fuel, and for rockets and doing some testing. Here's one of those rockets actually being tested. And we actually developed what was called the Rocket Engine Test Facility. And then, of course, some of the work lines is from the test safety of the test zone. And that's the Rocket Engine Test Facility there. And then came 1958 with the forming of NASA. And we were actually became a part of that. The three NACA centers became NASA research centers, and then we started adding on to that. So I'm just going to skim through a couple things real quick. I want to show you a little bit more here right away, keeping us on the path to space, getting ready. One of the real interesting facilities we had was something called the Multiple Axis Space Test Inertia Facility. MASTIF is an acronym form, or just called the Gimbal Rig. And the Mercury astronauts came and trained in the early 1960s to start training on that. It was basically from February 15th to March 4th, they all came through and tested on the Gimbal Rig. And here is Gus Grissom and Alan Shepard outside the rig. And there you can see, so it was a testing to have the pilots test gaining control of a spacecraft if it was in any way out of control in any one or all three of the control axes. And when it was all done, this was kind of like their final test. They had a spin, bring the platform under control in all three axes, and this is what it looked like. No, it looks like it's not going to do that. Sorry about that. I can try to share a little bit more about that later. Of course, we started doing some other testing, preparing the Mercury rockets for launch, including their escape tower. And here's some firing of one in the rocket laboratory. And this is the development of hydrogen and oxygen testing a little bit more. And the result of that I wanted to highlight is the development of the Centaur rocket, the upper stage to the Atlas and eventually the Titan. And it's through the power of the Centaur that we've been able to do the tour of the solar system. Both the Voyagers were launched on the Titan Centaur, and even more recently on top of the Atlas V, although they don't call them Atlas Centaurs anymore, the Atlas V still has a Centaur upper stage that got us, that got Curiosity to the surface of out towards Mars, and even most recently Pluto Horizon sent it on its path out that way. So it's part of the very proud heritage that we have there. So as we kept on going, this is what NASA Lewis looked like in the 1970s. And we eventually added on our Plumbrook facility, which is in Sandusky, Ohio. We took that over in 1963, I believe it was from the Army. And on the left, you see a Skylab shroud being tested there. It's what protects the payload on its way up through the atmosphere. During the 70s and the energy crisis, who better than a bunch of people who have wind tunnels and jet engines and have expertise in power development to work on solutions towards practical solutions for the energy crisis. So we were heavily involved in wind turbine research. And that's one of the wind turbines out at Sandusky at the Plumbrook facility. And then more recently, we've done testing on airbag landing system for the Mars rovers. Those airbags are actually now on display at our visitor center, which is located at the Great Lakes Science Center. So if you come to town, I encourage you to visit that as well. And of course, through the years, we've continued on. We're very heavily involved in the space shuttle. Of course, space shuttle had hydrogen oxygen flowing through its main engines. We've done microgravity research on board the space shuttle and now aboard the space station. We have two refrigerator-sized science racks on there that we send up experiments. Again, part of the energy crisis, we won a Collier Trophy for our work on the Advanced Turboprop Project, and that's what you see in the middle there. And of course, work continues on the icing research tunnel. So as we wrap up here, NASA Glenn today, we actually renamed the center to honor John Glenn in 1999. You can see John and Annie there, and standing to Senator Glenn's left is junior senator from Ohio, Mike DeWine. He's one who put forth the legislation, and that was the great renaming ceremony that we had at the time. And today, this is what NASA Glenn looks like. We have a 350-acre campus on what we now call NASA Glenn Research Center at Lewis Field. 1,626 civil servants, 1,500 contractors. About 66 of the workforce are scientists and engineers. But as I was talking to another young man today, that means 33% of the workforce is non-technical, and so opportunities there as well. Then the Plumbrook Station out in Sandusky is 6,500 acres, much smaller workforce, but this is our workforce test facilities designed for more hazardous operations where we need to have a broader clear area. So in closing, Bill and I are going to take some Q&A, but let's do one more little clip from John Glenn, and we'll close out from there.
Oh yeah, well, I was proud of the fact that we had the old NAC laboratories, you know, were set up in different parts of the country. I was always proud we had that one in Cleveland, and it was doing some of the foremost work, as people that work there are well aware, some of the foremost work and research, and you know, every bit of progress that people have ever made in any field, whether it's space or aeronautics or any other field, every bit of progress ever made is because someone was curious about whether we could do things in a new way or a better way, or could we fill in these blanks of information. And that was the role that NACA played, and then that became, when NACA became part of NASA, that's the role that NASA has played since then, still in aeronautics and broadening their base into the space program as well. That kind of research still is so important for our country, because to me, a nation that has led in any kind of research and along with that has had a good education system for all their people, that's what enables us to develop whole new industries like aviation you know, how you make steel or anything else. Somebody has to be curious about how you do this in a new and different way. And that's what NASA has symbolized in aeronautics and the space program.
That's inspiring to hear that. So just a little reminder that NASA is with you when you fly, whether you're flying your own personal aircraft or if you're flying in a commercial aircraft. Technologies that have been developed from over the past 100 years from the NACA have shaped the way the airplanes look, the way they fly, the comfort, the fact, even if you're not flying, you're sitting down. Of course, we hear a lot of loud airplanes here, but you don't want to necessarily hear them when you're in your backyard trying to enjoy a picnic. So we've done a lot of things over the years. And just in closing, personalize a little bit. This is a friend of mine talking about as a pilot. Oops.